everybody. Welcome back to the War Room, part of the Clone Star podcast. I am your host, Sho Hurley, and joining me this week is my usual co-host, Mike Overton. Mike, how are you?
I am good, thank you, Sho.
And this week we are absolutely thrilled to welcome a man who has got 183 credits to his name for composition of Star Trek episodes, nominated for 5 Emmys. And I'm going to list them out because they absolutely have to list it out. 95 for Caretaker, 96 for Armand Bashir, 98 for His Way, 2000 for Spirit Folk, and a winner in 01 with Endgame. It is the magnificent, and his hair and moustache are just as impressive as they were in all the photos I've seen over the years. It is Jay Chataway. Jay, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you. I flew in here on my ship to visit you, so here I am on the Enterprise.
Jay, it's absolutely fantastic to have you on here. So we're going to have to talk about Star Trek kind of later in the show, but one of the things we wanted to do, we wanted to kind of track your progress from the start all the way through. So in terms of, say, growing up and things like that, did you grow up into a musical household, or where did the love of kind of music come from?
That's always a great question. So I started writing music when I was in like middle school, like sixth grade or something like that. So I took piano lessons, I played the trumpet, and I started writing music for my junior high school band when I was just a kid. And somehow it worked out. You know, everybody asks that question, where does it come from? So it's sort of a gift, you know, like you have a gift for doing what you're doing, and Michael does too. And my gift apparently is to do music. And it just sort of came to me, and I started writing as a kid. I went to college and studied composition, like serious composition, and continued writing for all kinds of things. And went into, we had this war called the Vietnam War, and I was drafted into the service. And I joined the United States Navy as a composer arranger and with the U.S. Navy band. So I wrote tons of music and started doing film music for the band and the government. And I finally left that and went to New York City, became a record producer featuring jazz artists. My claim to fame in that arena was the artist Maynard Ferguson. I produced the original theme from Rocky, and that was my first record I ever produced was a gold record. Got a Grammy nomination, so I was off to a good start.
I would say so.
Yeah, so I produced a whole bunch of albums and formed a record label in New York called Tappan Zee Records, part of Columbia Records. And then was always interested in film and met a bunch of great young filmmakers in New York City. William Lustig, for example, one of his first films was Maniac, which I scored, which was my first film. But the first film that I really got hooked on was a film that I came to London, in Michael's territory, a film called Firepower with Sophia Loren and James Coburn. And I was orchestrating for a saxophone player named Gatto Barbieri, who's best known for his score to Last Tango in Paris.
Yep.
So Gatto had done the theme to this movie, but the movie was all finished. And previously on Last Tango, Bernardo Bertolucci just cut the film to Gatto's music. In this case, the music had to fit the film, and Gatto didn't really have the skill to do that. Of course, nor did I, but I figured it out, and he asked me to come to London and conduct the Philharmonic and orchestrate and help score the film. So there I was at 27 years old, conducting the London Philharmonic with Sophia Loren on the screen. So obviously I got hooked. It was pretty spectacular.
So Jay, when you were growing up, you said you wrote music. Like, did you write like lyrics, or did you actually write the music itself? Did you do kind of a combination of both?
Well, when I do songs, somebody else usually does the lyrics, and then I write the music to fit the lyrics. Sometimes it goes the other way. I'll write a song and somebody will write the lyrics to go with it. But mostly my music has been instrumental. Mm. I did write some songs. I wrote a Klingon opera for Star Trek and a bunch of albums with songs for other recording artists, but mostly my skills are in instrumental film, dramatic music. And I sort of learned how to help manipulate an audience through the use of music. It's very fascinating what you can do, especially in a scary movie. You can help people spill their popcorn or whatever they serve in your country when people watch the movie. But I found that to be fascinating. And you could do, if a movie doesn't have enough emotion to it, the music can certainly do that. It can speed up a section or slow it down. And it was it's a fascinating thing that we do. And I can't exactly tell you where it comes from, except from maybe some other source that I don't know how to define.
And when you were kind of growing up, like, what were your influences in terms of, say, musicians, or was it more kind of going to see movies in the cinema and realizing the music is having such an effect on me? Like, what kind of, drove your passion when you were younger?
I think it was a combination of both. I mean, since I was playing in bands and that sort of thing, I, of course, was gravitating towards instrumental artists, jazz musicians. I grew up near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, big jazz area, same area where Henry Mancini came from. Mm-hmm. And the interesting anecdote is that I got to meet Henry Mancini. We were both getting awards at a particular event, and I was able to tell him that he was my influence. When I was in college, I went to a concert. He was conducting the Pittsburgh Symphony in a concert of his film and television music. And I went to that concert and I got hooked by seeing that. And it was like, hey, I want to do that. So at this meeting, I mentioned that to him, and we both lived on a river. And we said, maybe there's something in the drinking water that made us become we became friends, and we spent quite a bit of time together. It was a wonderful experience. So it was I did see a lot of films as a youngster going to the movies, especially films where the music was really kind of important. A lot of Westerns, for example. Mm-hmm. And I sort of became an early fan of Ennio Morricone, and studied his work quite a bit. And in fact, when I worked with Bill Lustig on his films, he insisted that he and I would watch just about every Morricone film ever made, and tell me. I mean, he didn't really speak music like a music person would, but he could tell me what he liked about how that music worked and the difference between European made movies and American made movies, and how much more operatic and how much more importance the music has in those Italian movies, the spaghetti westerns and things like that. So that was a huge influence in my people that I studied and saw how their music worked. And I said, well, hey, I should be able to do that. But it's not as easy as it sounds. I mean, you can't copy what a person does, but you can figure out the technique as to what devices can trigger certain emotions in people.
So just out of curiosity then, Jay, now again, like, this is going to be an incredibly specific question that I'm going to ask you, and it's a very unfair question as well. What's your favorite soundtrack to a movie?
Ooh, boy. I would have to say The Mission by Morricone.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, I mean, what that film accomplishes is both using sacred and secular music in such a way. He was such a genius that he was able to overlap traditional spiritual religious type music with music from South America representing the secular part of it. And it intertwined perfectly and made such a statement that it just really, that would be my all time favorite. So there, it wasn't such a hard question.
So you've already mentioned a few times that you went to college. What did you study at college?
I studied music composition.
Right.
And I spent 5 years. I have a master's degree, and now I have a doctorate. You can call me Dr. J if you wish.
But Mike, will you make a note of that when we're sending out the notification of the message? It's Dr. J Chataway when we're putting
it's on my list. It's on my list.
I can't write prescriptions, however, but In academic circles, they refer to me as doctor. So, but yeah, I studied classical music, but I also organized the jazz program, the jazz band at the university. So my jazz roots were always sort of present, and they still are. So I play a little bit of piano and trumpet and things of that sort. But yeah.
So do you find? No, sorry, Mike, go on.
No, go on.
I was going to say that do you still find that, look, you're kind of retired now, do you still find that you still look to compose different things, or do you just kind of play like your existing compositions and things like that?
Well, as to how it happens, I try not to have to be able to play everything that I write, because I'm a much better writer than I am a player. So if I had to play everything on piano that I ended up writing, it would be pretty simplified. So yeah. I devised at one point a special desk, which it was like an old fashioned roll top desk, you know, and I had a keyboard on the desk, but I found myself just plunking away on the keyboard, playing stuff that I knew what it sounded like. So I was wasting an immense amount of time. So I covered the keyboard up by rolling the roll top down. I found I could write much more from my head than I could from my hands. So it became sort of more of a mental exercise than a physical one of performing it. Now, a lot of the newer scores are done by people simply playing into a keyboard, which is attached to a computer, and it then prints out the music. And I do that as well. But in all of the Star Trek episodes that you mentioned and everything else up until maybe 10 years ago, I did it all by hand, by writing on paper with a pencil.
So you're essentially imagining the entire thing.
Yes.
Rather than putting it into a keyboard to kind of see how it would sound, you were just essentially thinking it, as it were, and imagining that that's going to sound like that, that's going to sound like this.
Yeah, and in addition to that, when I would go to a screening of a film or a television show, I sort of heard the score in my head. Writing it all down is what took the tedious part of the thing. I mean, you know, you figure if you write 40 minutes of music, that's a ream of paper like this, you know. I mean, and we do stuff like Star Trek. It was all done in like a week to 10 days, including all the orchestration for all the instruments of the orchestra. So it was a pretty much sleepless 16 years.
So you mentioned as well, Jay, you were saying about that you conducted the London Philharmonic Orchestra at age 27. Just out of curiosity, like, how did that feel like a daunting experience to kind of walk in that door and say, I'm the one who's going to be telling all these experienced musicians what to do?
Yes, it was. I was terrified, actually. And it was it's an interesting anecdote, which I should probably mention this here, because in addition to that being my first encounter with the London Orchestra, we did a program. Maybe it was, I don't think it was in Ireland. In England, it was called Star Trek, The Ultimate Voyage.
And oh, yes. Yeah.
You know about that? Well, I conducted in the Philharmonic, and two of the players that were in my first film score were still in the orchestra, and they claim they remembered me. So we had a nice reunion, and I wasn't quite as terrified then as I was the first time, because, you know, in London and in England, this gets a little technical, but you guys record and project your films at 25 frames per second.
Yep.
In America, we do it at 24. Nobody told me that when I wrote the entire score for Gatto's film. So it was all computed to be at 24 frames a second. So I go over and I conduct, we did the theme, which came out great. And that's the only piece of music that the director was Michael Winner, a very famous director.
Oh, I know Michael Winner, yes.
Yeah. So he left, and then we went on to the first big action piece, started working on it. And Well, we got about two-thirds of the way through the piece, and the music and the film started to drift apart. And I thought, wow, that's kind of weird. Wonder what's wrong. Maybe they changed the film. I said, no, we didn't change the film. So we did it again. We recorded the piece and then played it back. And as the piece progressed further, it got further off. And finally, I said, "This, are you guys like playing a joke on me or like what?" He said, and the projectionist said, "Hey, mate, did you write this to 24 frames?" I said, "Well, yeah." He says, "Well, over here, we use 25. I said, "Oh, my God. The entire score, like 90 minutes of music is not going to work." He says, "Oh, but we can fix that. There's a little switch here on the projector." Yep. And they switched it over, and it worked. And also at that time, the orchestra recorded at Wembley, where the now it's soccer instead of or football instead of music. It was a huge studio. And they have a pub in the studio. So at 10 o'clock in the morning, the orchestra takes a break and they all go to the pub. So then they had a lot of fun with me because it was like, I learned that you do the hardest music at 8 in the morning because at 10 they go and start drinking beer. It gets a lot looser after that.
But so doesn't the music sound better afterwards, though?
It sounds a little less together, maybe. So they gave me some warm beer, and I was much more relaxed after that. So we had the orchestra for a week. I mean, imagine somebody giving you a symphony orchestra to play with for a week. It was like, this is cool. So
And just thinking, so Jay, at this point now, you were conducting, you've a good few movie credits behind you and things like that. How did Star Trek come about?
Well, I was away on vacation, and I have had an agent in L.A., and there was going to be an opening or a guest appearance on one episode only, and she submitted my music to the director of music at Paramount. David Grossman was his name. And David had heard my music previously, and he submitted a bunch of tapes to the producers. And one of the things I had on my demo tape was some music that I had done for Jacques Cousteau, the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau, where I had incorporated whales into the music. And I also got on a few motion pictures like Red Scorpion and a few others. And I had that on the tape. And when the Star Trek people heard that I was recording with whales, they thought that I might just be the weirdest kind of a guy that they could use on Star Trek, I guess. And so they chose me. And they didn't like have a contest. They just said, no, you're going to do an episode. So it wasn't like I went in for a meeting thinking it was just an interview. And they said, oh, here's the show. And you have 10 days to come back to score it. And it was Tin Man.
At this point, Jay, as you kind of mentioned, like you weren't the biggest Star Trek fan in the world. So like at this point, it was season 3 of The Next Generation and it was starting to kind of build up. Were you kind of in your head going, this is daunting because it's Star Trek and there's such a big community? Or were you kind of viewing it just as, it's just a TV show, I'm just coming in to do an episode on, come in, one and done, I'm out, and that's it? Or how did you feel about it?
Well, I was thinking that one and done was the real deal. I'd never thought for one minute that I was being auditioned to do more than that. And I was doing big time movies at the time. I was doing Maniac and Missing in Action, and I did Stephen King's Silver Bullet. So I was going to be a film guy, and I said, I don't want to do much television. And but my agent said, no, you got to do this. The music director is a friend of mine, and it could be good. It could be good for your career. So I did it, and it wasn't as smooth as I thought it was going to be. The coolest thing was that in a lot of the movies I'd been doing, except for Silver Bullet, which was a much bigger budget, we had to record a lot of the instruments separately because I couldn't afford a studio big enough to record 80 musicians or whatever. Star Trek records everything all at once, and it's mixed live, and everything is recorded in a day. I mean, the entire score, start to finish, is done in a day, and it's mixed in 2 days, and then it's on television. So from the time you record the music, 4 days later, people are watching it. And at that time, internet was a little new and they had message boards. So you people would like respond, like you were being criticized for every note you wrote. You know, it was kind of crazy. But it was apparently very well received, as opposed to the producers who maybe didn't receive it as well because it was so different than what they've been using.
Yeah.
I was told to do what my version of a space epic would be. So, of course, I referenced John Williams, who was another idol of mine, who was very a thematic writer. He wrote themes for everything. Like, mm-hmm. I think you could go to a John Williams scored film. You don't have to watch the film. You can listen to the music and get the whole story. It's like, yeah. You know what happens, right? And however, I did exactly that. And on Tin Man, I had themes for the Klingons and the Vulcans and the Romulans and everything. And including the Tin Man itself, which is this organic, described to be a beautiful, living, organic being in space. And of course, when you write the score for these, you don't see them. You don't, the visual effects are being done while I'm doing the music. So yeah. The beautiful, organic being in space was described as being this really amazingly beautiful creature. And when I saw it on screen, I don't get to see it until the day I go to record. And it looked like sort of a blob. And so I had these hearts and harps and frilly woodwinds and all this fancy shit going on. And of course I used the whales because they wanted it to be organic. So I said, well, what do I have that's organic? So whale songs, pretty darn organic. So that sort of fit. But the rest of it I had to change immediately. And all the themes, I did a 6-minute action piece as my first cue. And the producer said, oh, that's fine, but no, do something different. So I'm there with 60 musicians. And I said, well, what do you mean different? Well, you know, you have all those themes and stuff. We don't do that. So I had to go in verbally tell everybody to change some things. You know, and all the musicians, they sight read the music. They never saw the music before. And I never heard the music before except in my head. Yeah. So we pass out the music and they just play it. And so now I had to tell them, now you feel this note, you change it here, blah, blah, blah. It might have been that they were testing me to see if I could play the game, which I did. And it was very successful. It was a lot of fun and it sounded good. And then I went to the mix, they called it the dub, where they bring in the sound effects and the dialogue and everything. I couldn't hear the music. It was like, well, what's this about? Well, you see, the sound of the ship is much more important in space because we need to know that we're in space. So you've got this hum and this shh, like you're flying through space, but really, there is no sound in space, so why couldn't there be more music? So I told the head producer, I said, well, you've got like this epic looking space show and you can't hear, you mix the music like it's coming out of a box, you know, it's the story. So I didn't really care. It was a one-off for me. I wasn't, you know, I told him like, hey, this is crazy. You got to put the music up. Because I had just come from mixing Maniac Cop, right? Which the music was pounding and scaring people to death. So, and I was spoiled. And as soon as I went from the dub from Star, I went back to Maniac Cop and listened. I said, this is how it's supposed to be, you know? It never really did get improved upon much, but I made my comments and they still hired me back. So I guess they thought I was ballsy enough to tell them what I thought.
Anyway, I was about to say, was it your forthrightness that kind of got you really noticed, kind of saying, this guy is willing to kind of, you know, give it straight back to us if he thinks it's complete garbage what we're trying to tell him. And Jay, like from my own point of view, as I said to you before we started recording, like I love the music from Tin Man. We put up a post recently on Twitter asking people about their comfort episode of Star Trek that they might watch. Mine is Tin Man, and a lot of it is to do with the music that you have in it. And even preparing for this, you know, yesterday I was going for a drive and I put on the music, and as you said, there's this wonderful kind of Tin Man theme of kind of like being organic, and as you said, the whale sound as well, kind of done a bit differently. And then you have this cool militaristic kind of sound with the Enterprise's encounters with the Romulans as well. So it's this wonderful contrast as the episode goes by and the stakes kind of keep on kind of building. And Jay, I just want to bring back to one thing then, is that, so you are, at what stage do you get involved? Is it a case that this, basically that you don't get anything until they've done their recording, they've recorded the episode, they're in post-production putting in the special effects, Did they just give you an overall idea of what the episode is going to be about? Did they give you the script, or how does it work exactly?
We get a script early on, maybe as soon as the script is finalized and approved. And they're very secretive. The scripts are all numbered, so you can't like sell your scripts to, you know, the internet or whatever. They know who has which copy. So sometimes the scripts are so secretive that the last act, the last chapter, you might say, is not in the script when you get it, because they maybe they're still working on it. I'm not sure. But you get it. I would get a script maybe 2 weeks in advance. Then I would get a very rough version of the film on a video cassette. And everybody would watch that, the composer, the producers, the music editor. And then we have a meeting. We go to a meeting and we discuss where and when the music starts and stops. It's called spotting. And then they take very careful notes as to where that's going to occur. And then I go home and start writing the music. And as I'm writing, they're refining and editing the film. So the film is never really locked until the day I record. And sometimes even after that, it's changed, because all the visual effects have to be done to a locked picture. Yep. And all the audio effects have to be done. So it's a combination of some the chasing the tail, so to speak. When you see a big action scene, all there is a Chiron is typed. Klingon ship enters left. They fight for 4 minutes, blah, blah, blah. And so those scenes that are unfinished, I would just write action music with material that I would know that I would have to move when something bad would happen or something good would happen. The real germ of the philosophy of the music of Star Trek, as opposed to Star Wars, we can get into a long discussion about that, but I'll make it short. The Star Trek producers feel that their audience is very intelligent and should be able to make their own choices as to what's considered good or evil. In other words, Klingons may not be the bad guys. So why paint them musically as a bad guy fighting the Enterprise? Maybe there's a reason they're doing this, blah, blah, blah. So it's a philosophical difference that has caused the music to get some degree of neutrality as opposed to bombastically heroic or terribly villainous type of music. And that's the main theory of the difference. So that's my dissertation on the Star Wars, Star Trek thing. Since I'm a doctor, I can say that.
And Jay, when you were inside in that first meeting then, when you were kind of there with the producers and things like that, these are people you had met before and things along those lines. Did you feel uncomfortable? Did you feel at any point you were there going, I think we should do something here, but maybe I shouldn't say it. Maybe I shouldn't push for it. Or, and I could nearly guess that this maybe was your approach, was like, basically, fuck you, I'm the composer, I'm going to tell you what needs to be done here, and that's how it's going to be.
Well, as you may know, some of the composers that might have said that didn't come back for like 16 years. But I have to say that I was so impressed when I went to that meeting that not only did they know intimately the tape that I had submitted, they were able to reference that tape to various places in the show that they thought that type of music would be appropriate. So these were not musicians, except for the music editor. They were people who knew there was Rick Berman, who was the master producer of all things, and Peter Lauritsen, who was the executive producer of everything else. And then there was about five different people in the room. And I didn't know any of them. So I was sort of taken aback by the knowledge that they all had, because they all got a rough copy of the video and they all got a copy of my demo tape. And they could all speak intelligently, maybe not in musical terms, but in terms of what they felt the music was able to do, which I thought, you know, this is a bunch of very intelligent people that I could be working with. So I didn't mouth off too much, but I did tell them what I thought. And one second, Terry, could you grab the cover over in there? Okay. Well, you asked a question about the producers. Well, later on, when I'm doing Deep Space Nine, another producer came along. Terry Potts is her name, and she happens to be my wife now. And so,
okay,
if you want to talk to another producer in Star Trek, she's in the back room.
Oh my God, Jay! Yes, 100%. I know her name. She's one of the people I actually wanted to reach out to at some point. Right, this is fantastic.
Right here. And not only that, but I guess I can put in a plug. She is writing, or has finished writing, my biography.
Oh my God!
And can I show it now?
Yeah, of course. Before, you can.
Yeah. I don't know if you can see that. There.
Oh yes, the inner light. It's called.
Yes, it's called
Journey to the
Inner Light, and it'll be in print in the spring. So it's being printed and edited and all that sort of thing. Now it's a history of my, not just Star Trek, but all my musical endeavors and my other things that I do. So the producers are very important. You never know who you might marry, one of them, you know. So very cool. It's caused a few problems in our life. I mean, sometimes we don't always agree on everything. So she was telling me how to do my music then, and now she tells me how to do other things.
So now she tells you how to put the dishes in the dishwasher. Yep.
Exactly.
And Jay, just because of the title of the book, obviously we have to go on to it. The Inner Light and the Resican flute and the music and the theme that came from it, obviously, like, it's such a huge part of Star Trek lore, and it's continued even to this day. What was the influence in it? And also, did you think that all these years later, it would still be such a central part to the character of Captain Picard?
That piece of music came to me in about 10 minutes, literally in 10 minutes. And it's like, with all things Star Trek, you have to do alternate versions of things, like especially something that's so special that the principal character is going to play it and be featured in the show. And a lot of the theory behind it, okay, so the planet that he goes to, they were mostly metal mining engineers and workers. So it had to be a metallic instrument, figuring that that's what it would be. And it also needed to be an instrument that would not cover his face. Like if you played a regular flute, your hands would be in your face like this. Yep. But the Resican flute, which is basically a penny whistle, is held out here in front. So the camera could come into the face and get facial expression, et cetera. But the music, it just happened. And it being from Ireland, it has a little bit of a folk Irish kind of a lilt to it, you might say. But in terms of alternate versions, I had to submit two themes. So I wrote the one that came to me in 10 minutes as the one that everybody knows. And then I had to struggle to write one that I knew would sound worse, because what would happen if they would have picked the other one? Then the beautiful theme would be lost forever. So I did. And so fortunately, they chose the correct one, not knowing that I was going to write one that it purposely took me hours to try to figure out how to do something different. But interestingly enough, the second one was used in the show as what his son is playing, and followed up by being referenced in the Picard series as part of the thematic structure of the theme from Picard. So it didn't go to waste completely. And but the response to The Inner Light was fantastic. I mean, it is the most requested piece of music from the Star Trek catalog. And it you know, the theory of it, and going to having a family in a whole other universe and a whole lifetime in so many minutes, it won the Hugo Award for the best science fiction of that year. It was just one of those things that just happened instantly, and it's very appreciated. I read all the trades and all that, a lot of the comments all the time. And everybody says, well, I used it at my wedding. I played it at my parents' funeral and my graduation and all these things. It's very important and how it makes people feel. And interestingly enough, at the end of that show, you know, normally at the end of a Star Trek show, they go out with a big thematic, bombastic thing. And so that's one I fought very hard. I said, no, you know, he's playing that flute in his room. Why not just let that music play out over space when you have the Enterprise flying by? Oh, well, you have to write an alternate ending just in case, you know. And I did write a big bombastic ending for it. And again, fortunately, we used the solo flute. And I think that's what captured so many people's imagination that, wow, a solo flute in space. It's pretty cool. And
so
when you
wrote the alternative ending, Jay, did you integrate the flute music into that ending, the one that you didn't want them to use, or did it kind of just cut off the flute, just go back to the regular Star Trek music?
It was just going to cut off, and it was going to be Enterprise and Star Trek music playoff, you know, big time. And I suppose I could have developed it into something else, but I didn't want it to go that way either. I knew that they'd have to do it this way. And, you know, I don't think that's a voting thing, but when you go to the mix or the dub, they have these alternate versions available. They could just play one and then play the other and do that sort of thing. And then they chose the correct way. And that's what made it, I think, other than it being a pretty nice melody and have a lot of reference. That show is very powerful. I mean, even if you go back and watch it, how many 20 some years later, it's like, wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
If I had my little flute here, I'd play it for you, but
I have to ask you as well, Jay. So obviously you did in Voyager, you did Spirit Folk, which obviously has connections to Ireland, and because I'm Irish, I have to ask you, what did you use as your influences for it?
Well, I happen to really love Irish music, and where I live here, I live on the island of Martha's Vineyard, which I didn't at the time. I lived in Malibu, California, but I now live on this island, and Irish music is a very big thing here. Right after COVID was over, there was no live music happening during COVID, but the first band that played live in our area was an Irish band. And it was the happiest moment. I mean, this was way after I had written this piece, but there's something about Irish music that usually happens to take place in a pub or something where everybody's happy to begin with. But it's not necessarily very complicated music, but rhythmically it is complicated. I mean, there's a lot of cross rhythms between the bow drum and the fiddle and all this stuff. It's about variation.
Wait a second, hang on, Jay. Did you just say a Bodron?
Yes. How do you pronounce it?
Bowron.
Oh, okay. Well, that's how I thought you might. I thought it was...
Like I said at the top of the show, the Irish words are basically beyond comprehensible because you can read it and you're there going, it is absolutely not pronounced that way at all. So even though we have a DH there, it sounds like a W instead. So Bowron, it's actually what's
that's what it so, sounds like. Yeah,
yeah, no, like, yeah.
It sounds like it was named for the sound that it makes. I mean, in Irish, but no, we had a real Irish band. I mean, they weren't Irish. Well, some of them might have been. That was within the concept of the symphony orchestra that was recording the score. Mm. So we had how would you pronounce you? Ullian pipe?
Ullian.
Ullian pipe. Okay. We had an Ullian pipe, harp, a fiddle, a penny whistle. Let's see, what else? A drum. I'm not going to pronounce it your way because I'll mess it up again. Anyway, probably seven or eight authentic. They weren't symphonic players. They were Irish musicians. And so I wrote and they didn't all read music perfectly. So I had to teach them the music and have somebody sitting in with them to tell them when to start playing, so that I would go like, ready and now, and you play your instrument, and then they would play and the orchestra would accompany them. So it was quite the experience, and it really worked. I mean, it was kind of a silly episode when people turning into cows and things, but the music was cool enough that people thought it was worth Emmy nomination or something. So yeah, it was cool.
So how did you view the differences in the musical tones between the different shows that you worked on? Because obviously TNG sounds very different to Deep Space Nine, which sounds very different to Voyager, which obviously sounds very different to Enterprise. How did you, was that a struggle, or was that something that just comes easy to you?
Well, it was a struggle in that on Deep Space Nine, I actually had to score the first episode before the theme was finished.
Yeah.
And Dennis did the theme, but that episode didn't score yet. So I had to score an episode that took place. The episode I was scoring came, it was finished before the pilot was finished, let's say.
Right.
And so I had to write music. I kind of talked to Dennis. I said, well, what are you doing with the theme? Well, it's going to be trumpets. And he told me a little bit about it. And so I couldn't really incorporate it much because it wasn't done yet. So it was pretty hard to establish a vocabulary. But yet there is sort of a Star Trek vocabulary, as I mentioned, that can't be overly suggestive as to whether things are positive or not. The issue with Deep Space Nine was it was a confining, at least for a while, until the Defiant went out into space and did stuff, it was a confining character-driven show, which some people said, oh, that's a boring show, blah, blah, blah. But they didn't really, it's actually caught on much later when people understood the depth of what was going on characterization in that show. And that's the show that my wife was one of the producers of. And it was a challenge because they were trapped in a space station interacting with each other. And the music sort of had to reflect that. The music wasn't as big and bold as some of the other shows because it was more intimate. So that part of it was pretty easy. To go on to Voyager, now this Voyager was now going to be the first network show for the Paramount Network, UPN, as it was called. So now there's a lot more bosses telling people what to do, right? So more people telling you how to do the music. So the this was supposed to be much more action-oriented and maybe a little more contemporary in its approach. So between Deep Space Nine and Voyager, it was a pretty good definition of what the differences could be. The challenge was that Dennis and I were both doing, we would come back from doing a Next Generation show, and there would on our desk would be the next Deep Space Nine show. So you just finished recording 20 minutes of music for Next Generation. Now you have to start writing, usually the same night, because with only two writers at the time, we were turning out a show every week. And you figure 40 minutes of music in 10 days, that's pretty challenging for anybody. We didn't have any outside orchestrators, or it was crazy making. And then when Next Generation finished, Voyager started and overlapped with Deep Space Nine.
Yep.
So now the same thing, but now they started bringing in some guest writers and it helped a little bit, but it was still, Voyager was more musically intense because there was much more action. When Enterprise came along, there was a new sort of move to be more contemporary. And I'm sure you've talked to people about their visions of what the theme sounded like using a pop song from another movie. But
we'll glaze over that.
Yeah, okay. But I didn't have anything to do with that. So that was not my anything to do with that business. But we were also challenged budget-wise, because every maybe third episode had to be done all electronically because they couldn't afford budget to budget, yet they could afford massive sound effects and the visual effects, but the music budget wasn't as substantial as what it had been. So we would sort of say, well, I have a huge action show, I need the orchestra. Or if I had a sort of a what's called a bottle show, which was not a lot of action, but maybe a lot of atmospheric kind of music, then we'd do that one electronically. So we would save, out of 26 episodes, we might do 18 of them with orchestra and the rest electronically. And it wasn't my favorite. I mean, I do electronic scores now, but there's nothing as rewarding as getting up in front of a big orchestra, playing music you just finished writing the night before, waving your arms and having it come back in your face. Computers don't do that. They don't say, hey, nice chart, man. They don't say anything. They just say, you know, just crash in the middle of it. And
yeah, it just gives you a beep and a middle finger to say, no, not today. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So, and the other thing too is when it's on computer, it gives the producers and other people so much more creative control that they can like move in with you and say, well, what's it sound like if you do this? Well, you do the whole thing and it sounds different. Oh, I kind of liked it the other way. And you got to change it. But it just, you know, I was always thinking of putting a parking meter in my studio. So for as long as they would stay, they'd have to pay more money. But that didn't work out that way.
I love that idea. Okay, I'm going to steal that idea. I'm going to stick a parking meter in my office, and then I love that one. So out of the four shows that you worked on, four Star Trek shows that you worked on, which one was your favorite? I'm guessing, I think I know the answer, but...
Which of all the Star Treks was my favorite?
Yeah, out of the shows, which was your favorite show to work on?
The Inner Light.
And then, okay, so from an episode, it's The Inner Light, but from an entire show?
Oh, The Next Generation was my favorite.
Just don't tell your wife.
I better not tell. Actually, I should say Deep Space Nine, because that's where I met my wife.
Yeah. But do you mind me asking, Jay, what was it about The Next Gen that you preferred over the others? Is it just because that was your introduction to Star Trek, or was there something about the music you were making for TNG that you feel kind of resonates better as the years have gone by?
The cast of The Next Generation to me seemed to be like, if they were giving awards like they do for movies for the best combined cast, yep, and how they interplayed with each other, interacted, I just thought that cast was perfect. I mean, the way everybody played off of each other's emotions and the way it was written. It was also earlier, so the longer it went on, the more it got a little watered down from the concept that I saw in that show.
Yeah.
It was new to me. It was new, and I found it to be exhilarating. It was like doing a movie, a separate movie every week, whereas some of the other shows seem to be more dependent on what came before. I mean, a few exceptions, like when the Borg got introduced or more developed in Voyager, those shows were very powerful. And of course, the Endgame, the only one I actually won the Emmy for, I think that was a pretty good episode, but it was a good visual episode as well. And the unique episodes that I was able to do, I have favorites all along. The Armand Bashir was one, and A Fistful of Data's in Next Generation was really if you really look at the process of how the composers had to sort of toe the line, up until that time, they really didn't want me to go into the Western mode on that show. Yet you have all the actors speaking in a Western dialect or dressed up in cowboy hats and spurs and acting like people from the Wild West. and just playing space music, I just didn't think that would work. So when I went into that show, I came in with some music from Morricone from Once Upon a Time in the West. And I played it for them. I said, this is how we should do this. No, no, you can't do that. I said, really? I said, people would crucify me if I didn't acknowledge everything that you're doing visually and aurally in this show. It would just be awful. Well, you can try it, but make sure we have an alternate. And so they would have a gun battle, and it was total Morricone. It was guitars and harmonica, bass harmonica on Star Trek. Wow, that's something different. and two guitars and a banjo. I mean, my goodness. But then when Worf pulls out his phaser, the music, bang, is Star Trek music. So the trick is to combine those elements in such a way that it would be convincing, but you weren't like copping out on the Western thing or overdoing the Star Trek thing. And they bought it. And from that time on, the composers, well, mostly Dennis and I, were able to then show them that this is okay. Like, can you imagine trying to do Armand Bashir without paying some homage to James Bond? I mean, the whole show, really. I mean, everybody got in trouble on that one, okay? But I was able to do the Deep Space Nine theme in Bond style and make it work. The show Bada Bing, Bada Bang, the same deal. Like, that was a caper show that was like Ocean's 11 in space. And the Deep Space Nine theme was done Ocean's 11. And they loved it. I mean, that was a really fun part of the scoring. And when they brought in the singer, the Lounge Lizard, it just lightened things up quite a bit on Jimmy Darren's part. And so it was all fun. And the coolest part about him, we recorded all of his music at Capitol Records in Hollywood, where Sinatra and all the big people like that recorded. So it was very authentically done. And including my original song that nobody knows where it came from is San Antonio Lady. Everybody says, I don't know that song. Sinatra never did that. And I said, no, because I wrote it. It's brand new. So anyway, so there's a lot of fun things to do. But Next Generation was my favorite. And those other episodes I mentioned were maybe favorite episodes within their discussion.
So talking about your process, because I mean, so I'm a music nerd. I trained as a sound engineer, so I have a pretty good understanding of how it works. But for those who don't, which process do you prefer? Do you prefer the processes of old where it was pen to paper? Or do you prefer the processes now where you would put it into a DAW such as Logic or Pro Tools or Cubase, and you can kind of tweak it as you go? Or do you prefer that pen to paper, that is how it is, and then?
Even when I do something in my, I work in Logic, but I still sketch it on paper. Right. Because there's something tactile about rubbing a pencil or a pen on a piece of paper without having the aids of having a digital workstation. What I found when I try to do it differently, I find that I'm a tweaker. I'll get like two measures that are really good, and I tweak it till it's dead, and I don't get anything else finished. You know, I have to write 40 minutes of music. So I've got two measures that are terrific, but I'm busy like, oh, let's see. What if I add a little EQ on this note, or I'm going to digitally edit it just to be a 30-second note different, then I don't get any work done. But if I have a piece of paper, and I'm very diligent about, like, actually all my scores are available. I donated them to West Virginia University, and you can go online. And if you wanted to study and see the manuscript scores of all the Star Trek episodes, you can do it on every page.
I know where I'm going after this call.
Yeah. I mean, I assume anybody can do it. I mean, I'm not sure the technique as to how you do it, but That was where I graduated from, and I felt that that school should have the music. And so I teach there usually 1 week a year, and we pull some Star Trek episodes and we pull the scores and study. The students can actually see the music and see how they fit with the videos. Not just Star Trek, but all my film music and jazz music and everything is there. But the I guess the important thing is that when it's a computer driven, it's so for me, because I didn't come up with computer stuff. We didn't even have, I came up with an Apple II was my first computer, and the notation part of it was pretty elementary.
Yeah.
Yes, you can get your ideas down in the thing, but the fact that you could tweak it till the cows come home, so to speak, would take forever. And so I would waste so much time finessing some music in there. Now, I know that a lot of people just put the very basics into their workstation and then they ship it off to somebody else to finish it or do all the tweaking. But in my case, I like to see that blank piece of paper. And then at the bottom of every page, in order to keep a time, you figure, okay, what if you have to write 3 minutes of music a day? It doesn't sound like much, but 3 minutes of action music, that's a lot of pages. So yeah. I would start at 8 a.m. This is before the pub is open. And I would put on the page at 10 a.m. I have to be at this point on the paper. So if I got to that point, I would take a break and I would go for a walk. I'd walk down to Starbucks to get a coffee or something and come back, and then I'd continue working. And at the end of the day, I had to be at a certain point. Otherwise, if you didn't get your 3 minutes finished, and you say you didn't do anything that day, the next day you have to do 6 minutes.
Yeah.
Like if you got sick or you had a family crisis or a kid needs to get delivered to a sporting event or something, your time frame, you either get it done or you don't sleep. You can't show up at the recording session without any music. Other people have tried that. It doesn't really work. So I'm thinking that this should sound like this. So here we go. No, they need to have something in front of them to make it work. So that was my technique, is how I would get through the day. And it became very important for me to live up to those deadlines and get everything finished. So one of the problems that I had when 9/11 happened, I was scoring a big epic show. I can't remember the name of it, but it was all about battles and people getting blown up. And here we are in real life living what the show was about. Yeah. And I was stumped. I could not write for like 3 days. I had to I can't get this out of my system. Finally, I just stayed up and didn't sleep for 3 days, and I wrote the score. And it was pretty good, but it's how other things get in your head that affect what you're thinking about. And it's almost like there's a block. And when the block happens, nothing is transmitted into your brain. Yeah. I mean,
it's writer's block, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that
one theory I have is that the music is up there anyway. Anybody, it's up there for grabs, but only certain people know how to grab it, you know? And I was one of the lucky ones. So I got the grabber tool and pull it down and make music out of it. That may be a little too esoteric, but it's kind of like Star Trek-y. So, you remember the episode where I think it was Dax? It was about the host. And the host changes bodies, and one of the bodies was a composer.
Yep. Yes.
And so the person kept humming this tune all the time, which also happens to be that composer was also, I think, a murderer or something.
Yeah, so, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, stuff like that in those shows was brilliant. I mean, how you could change from, you know, you have a being that looks like an octopus or something inside of you, and it can go from body to body, sometimes sex to sex, and people still love and hate and remember songs from there. It's an amazing concept.
And Jade, the fact now that you couldn't remember an episode of DS9 means Terry is off in the background staring at you going, I'm going to give out to him as soon as he's finished recording that interview.
Well, you know, occasionally I go to these conventions and play concerts. And I found out the big convention in Las Vegas, for example, maybe 3,000 or 4,000 people in the audience. And I could play two notes of a piece of music. They know who the guest stars are in the show. They know who the writer was. And like, I couldn't remember who those people are, but the fans are uniquely brilliant and able to identify these paradigms of what it's about. And people say, well, how did you know that person? I said, I didn't know. I was just writing the music, you know, like really. So it's fascinating how deep into it everybody really gets. And then they dress up and it's like, it's crazy making. But we did one concert in Pasadena, California, where Patrick Stewart was the guest speaker right before we went on. And so Patrick wanted to play. He wanted to play his penny whistle with the band. And I said, oh, and he can play it. He actually did learn to play it, but maybe professionally speaking, but we had him sort of covered, but he did. There were like 5,500 people in that hall, and it went nuts when he walked out with a penny whistle. So it's very, very popular thing we're doing here.
And just in terms of, say, like the years have gone by and things like that, do you still stay in contact with the likes of Dennis and some of the other people then that you kind of worked with, say, in when you were on Star Trek?
Absolutely. Dennis and I are good friends. And even though we're now 3,000 miles apart, we do get together. We email and we talk to each other. And he's a good talker, too. So if you want to get him on the show, it would be interesting. We've done a couple things together. In fact, Ron and Dennis and I did... on one of the commercially released DVDs, we did a roundtable discussion. I don't remember which one it is. There's many of them. So it was interesting to have everybody there and talking their own way. Dennis was very helpful to me because I came into this, as you mentioned, as a one-off, and then it became a more than a one-off. And because when I was asked to become a regular, I said, no, I'm honored, but it seemed to be very restrictive. Like, there's nothing else you can do. You do Star Trek, and except when that you might have 3 months off in the summer. So if you can grab a movie, or I would do a National Geographic or something in that time. But I told the producer, I said, his name's Peter Larson. I said, I can't do it, Peter. He says, no, Jay, you don't understand. You have to do this. I said, well, I don't have to do it. He says, no, they knew at the time about all these other offshoots they were going to do. I didn't know that. I thought, this is one off show. And like, we want you to do every other show. I said, well, can't do it. He says, no, Jay, you trust me. I know what's good for you. You have to do this. I'm totally in his, you know, he was absolutely right. He knew there was going to be a Deep Space Nine and possibly Voyager was in the throes of being developed. I didn't know any of this. So, what was going to be a one show of 16 years of space music. So, yeah.
And just kind of like, James, we're starting to wrap up. I'm going to ask you one last question that kind of ties in everything you just said there. So you weren't the biggest Star Trek fan kind of growing up and all that kind of thing. You wanted to get off it after one because you were there going, forget this nonsense. But then you went on to make 183 episodes of Star Trek. So, our question to you, Jane, and however you want to sum it up, what does Star Trek mean to you?
Oh, that's a great question. Star Trek was able to allow me to express myself musically in just about every mode that I could imagine and have it be received by millions and millions of people. And it just made me feel great. There.
Beautiful. Short answer. It's absolutely lovely. Jay, it's been absolutely magnificent talking to you. I'm 100% going to watch Tin Man now this evening as a result of this. So Jay, okay. Thank you so much for coming on. Mike, as usual, thanks for being on as well as co-host. So guys, this has been wonderful. I hope you enjoyed this conversation we've had with Dr. Jay, and we will see you again next week. Until then, thank you all very much.